Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
On the mic much when you're DJing, or do you tend to let the music do the
I don't just DJ, I mean I sing in the Dub Pistols and
of course
MC anyway, so
when you're doing your DJ sets
when
though.
I'm DJing, no, when I've been doing the live streams, yeah, I've been I guess we're just doing a mic check, right?
Yeah
when I'm doing
we're in it, this is it, straight in.
What's the
format, the premise,
vocabulary?
You can say whatever you want.
Shit, fuck, ass, cunt,
anything you want.
Right,
yeah, it is completely free range.
It's totally doable.
And the more outrageous the stories, the better.
Right,
to be honest, Barry.
Fine, no worries. That's okay.
And thanks for having me over, man.
That's
I really appreciate it. It's a really nice part of the country. This is as well. It's nice to just be. Right now, at least, out of the city. Like, it feels like the party's over. There's red tape and PPE everywhere. You know, everything's closed down. And it really feels like the party's over. Everybody's gone home and you're like the last straggler. That's the sort of overriding vibe.
I think I was lucky enough to... I spent most of my adult life in West London. And I think moving to the countryside and probably saved my life. From drink and drugs and various, because I'm, you know, I think in a whole year, I think, should I turn my phone?
Yeah, get him on silent mode.
Before I got married and moved to the countryside, I think I'd had the total of one night in a whole year.
Wow.
So, you know, moving to the countryside was, one, probably saved my life and my liver. So, and also being out here, like you said, during lockdown has been absolutely amazing because, you know, I can't imagine what it's like being in a city. I've just been able to walk for miles and not see anybody and, you know, not have to come into contact with people. So it's not really like being a lockdown for me.
Yeah, kind of life goes on.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, I'm starting to get a bit cabin feverish now. Where I'm feeling like, well, you know, I could do with probably doing a show, so... But
usually this time of year, I presume you guys would just be out throughout summer pretty much every year. Is that still the setup for the Dub Pistols?
I think...
Or have you slowed down on the festival circuit?
We've had to slow down now because obviously a year's been cancelled. But previous to that, we tour 11 months of the year. I normally take 6 weeks off or 4 weeks off and go to Thailand.
What kind of time of year is that? When's the downtime?
January.
And that's just full rehab, chill.
It never used to be. I used to go and DJ and literally would play every other day. And finally, my wife said, look, we need to have a break and stop being dragged around. And I didn't really need to do it. I just, I, I, it's just, you know, it's just something I've always done. I've always performed. I've always played, and I thought if I'm somewhere, I may as well just, you know, I may as well play some records or do a party. So, but just dragging my wife around from island to island every day, and club to club, was like, this isn't a holiday. You know,
she sounds like a patient woman.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she, you know,
how long have you been together?
We've been married. This will be our third year. Been together about 8 years. But I mean, you know, her mother was married to Mark Bolan, so
oh wow,
she comes from rock and roll royalty.
I bet she's got some amazing stories there.
Yeah, some pretty incredible. Elton John's her godfather. I mean, her mum passed away sadly quite early on when she was quite young. But I think she went to Freddie Mercury's 50th birthday. Yeah, I mean, that was her herself. But yeah, I think her mum had slept with David Bowie and shagged Syd Barrett. So she, you know, yeah, she was a pretty much a
glam queen.
Yeah, she was a glam queen.
I just met the guy who plays Elton John, Taron Egerton, in Aberystwyth last weekend.
That was that?
Really nice guy. Yeah, he was having like a party out in the woods for his mate's 30th, and he invited us out there. And we went out, and I was just like, it's cool that he's now obviously this internationally renowned superstar, famous actor, but he's still, you know, holding it down in Aberystwyth with his old school friends. And I like it when you see that.
Yeah, I don't see any reason to change. Do you know what I mean? I don't.
A lot of people do, though, don't they? The fame bug gets them, and
yeah, and they get drawn in and they move away from their friends. But I mean, I haven't been in the music industry for a long time. But also before that, I was in the film business as a assistant director. And 99% of the people I met were cool. There was only a couple of real arseholes.
What did you work on during that period then?
God, I did everything from the Brits, the Crays, the London Fashion Awards, mostly commercials. So that it, because I was freelance, and that gave me the give me enough money by doing a couple of days work a week to be a musician. So I didn't ever have to be a poor musician.
Nice.
Do you know what I mean? So because it was quite a well paid business.
And you came in through the sort of club promoting angle, right? So when you started performing in the Dub Pistols, were you at a fairly established level, or you could at least get yourself onto fairly bills?
The way it started was I went to Ibiza in 1987. I wanted to, like everybody, every schoolboy, I wanted to, or that in that sort of year, in those sort of days, everybody wanted to be a footballer. I wanted to be a footballer. Thought I was half decent. I wasn't really. And I got an injury, and I went to Ibiza in 1987, and I took a load of pills, and I basically never went home. Do you know what I mean? It was like, you know,
that was your awakening.
That was it.
Put me in the scene of that year, that summer, that time.
Well, it was a strange time, because obviously it was very much in the Thatcher years. There was a hell of a lot of everything. You know, there was all the football violence. There was all the, you know, there was all the you couldn't go from city to city, do you know what I mean, or area to area, you know, everything was territorial, you know, so you very much grew up in your area and you stayed with your friends and you would literally go to war with neighbours, do you know what I mean, like, you know, neighbouring city, towns, cities, whatever. And then went to Ibiza in 1987, took ecstasy, and it just was just a life-changing sort of nice cliche, and it's whatever, but it suddenly it was like, suddenly it was love and hugs, you know. And I remember, you know, being, because then I came home and started running parties. I came home and started putting clubs on. We used to do a club called Monkey Drum on a Monday night.
In London,
that literally everyone from the Stone Roses, Paul Rokenfold, Danny Ramplin, all those kind of people used to come, Soup Dragons, everybody used to come down to that sort of club.
And did you vice versa go up to the Hacienda as well and experience that side of it?
Yeah, no, and then that was sort of like one of our earlier clubs. And then we did quite a lot of different nights, but our biggest night was Naked Lunch, which I guess was one of the biggest clubs nights in London, if not the UK at that time. And that kind of built up a network from that, which included sort of like Back to Basic in Leeds, Cream in Liverpool, Hacienda in Manchester, The Bomb in Nottingham. And
was Dave Beer one of the guys around that
time? Dave Beer is one of my oldest and dearest friends. Yeah,
I met him through Pritch. We did a show with Sanchez in Sheffield, and I want to say it was like the last Back to Basics night.
Right, but it's always the last Back to Basics.
Dave moves, caveat just to make it a big party.
No, certainly not. No, Dave just moves around from a, you know, it's obviously it'll be the last back to basics night in that venue.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Because what tends to happen when you run nightclubs is they have a longevity in a certain venue and then they die off, and then you'll go and find another venue, you'll start again, and you'll have another year or 2 years of success, and then it will all fold. I think Dave's certainly a big pioneer and a champion and a leader.
If you just watch the wire at the bottom.
Okay. Obviously been a pioneer, a leader and a champion, but he's obviously, I mean, you know, Back to Basics was up there with your Creams. It was up there with the biggest nights in the country. I think Dave was a bit like myself in that he liked to party, so it was more concentrating on the party side of it than necessarily the business side of it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
he still does from the
absolutely
from the night I was at. It was one hell of a night.
Absolutely, you know, he
he's a lifer, right?
Yeah, that's Dave Beer. Anyone who knows Dave Beer knows, you know, you're going to have a fun night. But what that meant was, like, obviously your Creams and that had a bit bigger vision, do you know what I mean? And so obviously took it on to being festivals and, you know, took it around the world and made it into a multi-million pound business.
Like a brand.
And Dave probably put most of it, you know, into you know, various different chocolates and flowers. I had to write an article once where I had to explain how I came to lose $1.5 million, and one of the code words for that was chocolates and flowers. Everything was chocolates and flowers, which obviously was not really the case at all. It was you know, mostly chemicals,
sweets and treats,
chemicals and strippers and nightclubs, and, you know, but
you're obviously not aware of how much money you're pissing away when you're in the moment, though. Or were you very much just caution to the wind?
No, I think what
we're here
what
for
happened,
a good time, not a long time.
No, I mean, there's a few different reasons. One of them, I, like most musicians, I kind of got myself into tax troubles I got myself into financial troubles. So having had $1.5 million deal, I came back and I thought I had about 120 grand left, and I was 16,000 overdrawn. And so you suddenly get into these dark places, and I knew that I owed the tax man this load of money. I knew that I, you know, there was another thing that happened in 87, which was the Myra's thing. I literally just bought this flat, and just before I went to Ibiza, and the Myra's thing came in overnight, literally, and it was only a £60,000 flat, but overnight the interest rates went up to 15.5%. The flat dropped from 60,000 to 40,000, which was a lot of money at the time.
Yeah.
And I just, like I said, just thought, oh, fuck it, and just fucked off to Ibiza, threw the keys and didn't bother, just knocked it. So I always knew that I couldn't actually, in my head, I didn't think I could actually ever own anything. I never faced up. I just buried my head in the sands and just went off on a bender. And so anything I ever got, it just didn't feel like it had any value. I just, anybody could have anything. Because I knew that if I ever owned anything, they were just going to take it off me. So yeah. I just absolutely spunked.
So that embeds
everything.
This very kind of, I guess, specific mindset, doesn't it?
Yeah, into spunk your... everything.
Yeah.
Get, you know, just do it. Go big. Go hard. And you know, I did. I mean, I parted my way around the world and had the absolute time of my life. I mean, I'm still, you know, it came on top because in the end the tax people were going around to my grandmother's in Tuas Spasses and knocking on the neighbor's doors asking if they'd seen me, and I just thought, I can't
bring in trouble
anymore
to their door.
I can't
yeah.
bring in, you know, my grandmother's certain age, and I just thought, I've got to deal with this. Which, if anything's a lesson for anybody in this, is if you, when you face up to these problems, they ain't nowhere near as bad as you think they are. You can negotiate, because when you haven't got anything, it's the best good place to negotiate.
Nothing,
you know what
lose.
I mean? It's like, yeah. But when, and also when you face up to them, you know, the people, they will deal with you. They like, you know, the way that I got through it was that my accountant had explained to the tax man that I was a recovering alcoholic and junkie, and that basically I'd fucked everything, but I wanted to come back into the system, and we negotiated a deal which was, you know, more than reasonable, and suddenly I was in the clear. Do you know what I mean? It was suddenly I could actually be legal. I could be legit. I could be above ground. I could actually have savings. I could actually do things. Do you know what I mean?
Because you'd showed that willingness to want to redeem.
Yeah.
Or repay.
Well, I had no choice. Like I said, the grandmother came, you know, they were going around my grandmother's. They weren't going to give up. This was going on for like 15 years, you know. It was like, so, but the minute I actually could legitimize myself and set up a limited company and start running things properly, then my whole life changed. You know, it was literally like, you know, I could save, I could get a mortgage, I could, you know, run the business band as a business rather than just as a party machine.
And, you know, obviously all these years later, not right now, of course, because of lockdown and COVID, but to be still in control of it. And I guess existing outside of the system, you've been one of those bands that have enjoyed such longevity. And because you've just floated just below that kind of top tier mainstream radar, right? So there's never been like you're at the top of the mountain and you can fall off. It's like you're constantly just grinding away and building organically and gradually and continually. And
I think I've always described ourselves as the most successfully unsuccessful band out there, you know, which is, don't get me wrong, I mean, my company's called What the Fuck Could Possibly Go Wrong Limited. Do you know
and that's
what I mean?
Going to be the name of the documentary.
And that's the name of the documentary.
Incoming, right?
Yeah. But it really is the story of every band. You know, you fly high, everybody loves you, and then everybody turns their back on you, and then you drop like a, you know, like a, just like a brick out of an aeroplane, basically, to the floor. And then you sort of rebuild, and then you regroup. Most people don't get to go on, I guess. I guess if it was a normal band structure, i.e. there was five of us that were all doing it, but it wasn't, it was kind of me, and then other people have come and gone and blah, 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 but it's been me, so I've just carried on going.
It's a similar kind of a setup to the Asian Dub Foundation, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah,
I had Steve on the show about a year or so ago.
So, I mean, we've got to a situation now where we are, it's more like a cult. We have a decent, you know, we have a cult following that's like a loyal fan base. So therefore, it doesn't really affect us if what radio or press or what everybody else is saying, we're selling out shows and doing our thing and people are, you know, coming, you know, we're basically surviving without the need to, you know, be promoted like a new up and coming band and have to have tons of money thrown at them and God knows what, do you know what I mean, and tour supported and things like that. You know, we make most of our money from touring and merch, do you know what I mean, rather than record sales, which probably is the case for most bands now, I guess.
Yeah, well, I think you're one of those bands a bit like Madness as well, not musically, but well, a little bit musically, but yeah. Kind of like it's fun for all the family and the dads will then eventually become parents, well, the kids will become parents and then their kids come along. Do you feel like and see that there's always like an influx of newer, younger?
It's amazing. I mean, definitely, certainly different places in the country, but you know, like say like Brighton, places like that, you know, where we set up Concord and things like that. The average age is really quite young, but it goes up, like you said. You know, I'm 55 this year, so our audience seems to be anything from sort of like 20 to 55,
yeah,
plus. Do you know what I mean? But I mean, it just amazes me that we have managed to sort of maintain and grow new fans continually.
What was going on with you musically before the club scene comes into the fold? When you're a kid and you're, you know, like a young adult, what were the bands and the songwriters and the artists that were inspiring you then and that have stayed with you?
Initially, and which, you know, and quite a few of them I've got to work with, like, you know, like the Specials were absolutely my gods, you know, and I was lucky enough to have Terry and Limbaugh join us for a period. And before the Specials reformed, obviously Terry played with us for like 2 years. He brought Limbaugh along, he performed with us, and that was when they decided to restart the
so that was a catalyst really for that. Oh man,
they've admitted that themselves, you know, they said that, which is you know,
for a fan of that band, that's like the coolest thing you could ever do, right?
So the Specials, I guess, were, you know, they're there. Paul Weller, the Jam, obviously, were absolutely massive to me. The Sex Pistols,
that's all my stuff, man,
you know. So it was all that kind of thing. But I've been through, so you know, having been, you know, like I said, 55 this year, I've kind of gone through from the Specials. I got into my you know, to discuss, and the Clash, obviously.
Yeah.
Obviously, the Clash.
Did you ever get to meet Joe?
I never got to meet Joe. No. No. I've met Mick a few times. Sadly, not. Yeah. No, that would be one I would definitely love to have, you know, been able to tick off and say yes. So yeah, I mean, it was listening to bands like the Clash, the Specials, and because they had a reggae influence, and that kind of took me down into discovering more and more sort of like, you know, my sort of roots and the Jamaican sound and things like that as well. But then I went through the hip hop years, I went through the jazz funk years.
That's why that's all in the Dub Pistols. You know,
I went
cocktail.
Through the sort of indie rock years. Obviously, like, you know, your Stone Roses, Primal Scream, Happy Mondays. The reason I ever started a band was because of having watched the Happy Mondays enough times. I thought, well,
and how loose they were in the early
days. How loose
they
were. I thought, if they can do it, then I can do it, and that's exactly what happened, because I just wanted to be the highest person in the building and thought that would be the projection for the performance, do you know what I mean? And generally I was. I would probably pass out after about three songs and get carted off, do you know what I mean? But that's kind of where it started, and that was the sort of inspiration for giving the confidence to think, all right, I'm going to start a band.
How did the Geffen deal come about? Because this is the kind of the big large sum of money that you're referring to that got squandered that deal, right?
Yeah, it was a weird one. What happened was... I was in a band that was signed to Cowboy Records. We had a kind of semi-hit with a track with our Wooden Tops cover called Why. That kind of fell apart, and I just started doing suddenly, and I got bored of house music at the time, the way it was all becoming very cheesy and very obvious and very poppy, and the big beat scene started, I guess, with trip hoppy, then Amel House, whatever you want to call it. And so Wall of Sound label was there, and I just started making like breakbeat records, which were like more like DJ cannon fodder for me to
get the party started, right?
Out with. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It was never supposed to be a band. It was never supposed to be a album project. I made a couple of singles. I remember the first breakbeat track I'd done, with Monkey Mafia with John Carter, and because I was still signed to this other label, I couldn't sign as a band, and the idea was John would sign as the band to Heavenly Records, and I would be co-producer sort of thing, you know,
right.
Being it together, but officially I wouldn't be, if that made sense, but John decided officially that would be the case. Do you know what I mean? So we made the first single, blow the whole joint up. John signed to Heavenly, and I was kind of a bit like fucked, do you know what I mean? It was like so I kind of come up with a name. Ex-girlfriend of mine asked me for a name for a band, and I said Dub Pistol. She went, that's great. I went, yeah, you can't have it. So you come up with the name before I come up with the concept.
And was that just kind of drawing from the Pistols and then reggae?
Absolutely
dub
that.
And that combination
exactly,
of all those
exactly that.
Influences,
you know,
and loves?
It was exactly that. It was kind of like, yeah, punk rock in attitude and dub in sound. Do you know what I mean? So I started hanging out like the Wall of Sound Nights, the Heavenly Social, did a couple of tracks with Keith Tenniswood, Andy Weverell's partner at Sabersonic. Made this track called There's Going to Be a Riot. That was sort of that. When I first played it to the record company, they thought it was the worst record they'd ever heard.
That was the quote.
Sony, yeah. It was like that. But they didn't talk. They didn't call me for like 2 or 3 weeks. And they said, so I thought, as it was because of the fallout with John, and that was kind of a bit screwed in the head anyway at the time. And I phoned them up because I hadn't heard from them. Because they gave me £500 to make this demo. And I kind of phoned them up and went, what do you think of the record then? She went, a bit quiet. She went, shit. She went, this is a girl called Vanessa Rand, who's married to Tom from the Chemical Brothers. So I said to her, she went, I think it's the worst record I've ever heard. So I kind of went, she said, I think you better come in and see us. Do you know what I mean? So I kind of, it took about 2 weeks before the meeting happened, but I put the phone down. I was a bit insecure at the time anyway, to say the least, you know what I mean? Well, you know, drug psychosis and paranoias and come downs and God knows what. And
were you running around a lot of that time as, like, you know, a madman?
Yeah.
Out of his mind.
Because I was running clubs and things. So yeah. I was always at,
very little sleep.
I was always at a party. I was out 7 nights a week, like I said, you know. I remember going, so I was going playing it to people and I was going, it's not the worst record you've ever heard, have you? Do you know what I mean? It can't be that. Do you know what I mean? So 2 weeks went by. I went in to cut a long story short. I went in and said, "Well, play me the record." So they played the record, and they basically, what they'd been listening to was the digi dump from the sampler, which was on the front. Which obviously, for those who don't know, is like sounds like an old fax machine.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? It's like. Well, that's not the record. And I fast-forwarded it and played it to them, and they loved it. Do you know what I mean? Once they finally got to it. And Enemy made it single of the week. Steve Lamacq championed it all over Radio 1. And that was kind of it. We were off. Do you know what I mean? It was like, you know, suddenly we were...
Talk about a turnaround.
Yeah, suddenly we were flying, and then we had a hit with sort of, again, another minor hit, but it was the one and only track that we got playlisted on Radio 1, which was Cyclone.
And that's the tune that wound up later on in the Tony Hawk video game, isn't it?
Yeah, which...
Because they were huge, and so many kids, like, at that time, because that was around my age when I was coming up, that was our introduction to so many different bands and sounds.
That was our biggest marketing, so I think it was bigger than anything else. That was really what launched our career. I mean, what happened after Cyclone, then the record label said, "We want you to make an album," but we didn't really have an album, so we just cobbled a load of songs together and finished it.
Is that what became Point Blank?
That was what came Point Blank. And when we'd finished it, the big beat scene was a bit like, I guess, like the dubstep scene in terms of that. Obviously, dubstep was later, but it had gone, it created very fast a hell of a lot of big stars, you know, Chemical Brothers, Fatboy, Propeller Heads. The list can just go on and on. Do you know what I mean? It was like a hell of a lot of big acts.
Well, it was pop music, wasn't it? It became the chart stuff.
It was kind of, so that blew up. And then just as our album was due to come out in typical Dub Pistol style, there was this massive backlash against the whole sound and the whole scene. And
because it was successful?
But yeah, just like anything, like dubstep, suddenly it's not cool to be into it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. That's such a British thing, isn't it?
Very British. Very, very, very British.
Don't be successful.
Yeah.
Struggle your whole life. That's it. Keep your credibility.
Well, what they do in England is they tend to build you up, beat you down, and then just try and give you another lift up so they knock you down again. Do you know what I mean?
It's like,
you know, that's
very, and that's the same
the
now.
British way. Yeah, that's the British way. So just as our record was about to come out, just as it was coming out, I remember an NME review, and I remember it really well. And they called me the sound of Norman's sweaty jockstrap. Do you know what I mean? And the record label, and so the whole thing sort of bombed. And
do you think that's because of a snobbery towards working class music within the music press as well? Did you come up against that then?
I don't know. I mean, I've never really looked at it like that. Do you know what I mean? I've never really thought of it. I've never thought along on those angles. Was it because of my background? Do you know what I mean? I just kind of thought it was just part and parcel of the scene's done.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like,
but
luckily enough, there was a guy called Gary Richards, who had a record label, that had Crystal Method, etc. on it in America. And he absolutely loved the record, and he'd started a label with A&M, and he loved it and wanted us to sign to America. So our record label said, "Look, you're done here. You know what I mean? This is just not going to happen. We suggest you go and do that." And that's what happened. We went to America. We started doing really well in America. Straight off the bat, Cyclone was all over the radio. We were touring nonstop. Everything was going absolutely fantastic. First album was absolutely flying, and then A&M went broke. Do you know what I mean? So that was kind of, that was that. Do you know what I mean? When, like, typical dubstep. And then, so that happened, and then I sort of came home from America, and we were told to start working on another record, which we did. And because of America, like Point Blank was more of a DJ-led beats thing.
Yeah.
On the second album, we started working on more song-based sort of. Like,
and like an album, right? Which has a story.
Yeah, exactly that. And we did a track with a guy called Planet Asia, the Jordan Scher, and Jimmy Irvine, our manager at the time, Richard Bishop, was going into a meeting about Crystal Method, and Jimmy Irvine was playing this record that we'd done with Planet Asia's, and he said to our manager, listen to this record, it's the best record I've heard in like 10, 15 years. It's some band called the Dub Pistols, and Richard Bishop went, where's the Dub Pistols? I manage them. Do you know what I mean? He went, really? He went, yeah. He went, and literally within 2 days, I went out and signed $1.5 million deal. At the time, I was absolutely on my ass. Do you know what I mean? It was like, what the fuck? Do you know what I mean? I literally, like, you know, I had an old full Capri that the doors were stuck together. I used to climb out the window. It was just like, you know, life was pretty
down on your luck.
Down,
yeah.
Really down. Again, do you know what I mean? And then suddenly, next thing I know,
and he was signing up everybody then, right? It was this that kind of like golden age of Interscope? Yeah, so it was around that time.
Exactly that. It was exactly that. And he'd been given Geffen Records, and we were their number one priority. And we just they throw a shitload of money at us, and it was like, and we had 4 fantastic years of going and doing the Vans Warped Tour and touring.
Oh, you did the Warped, did you? Amazing. What year did you do that?
I can't even remember because my memory's so poor, it all just blurs into it.
Did you go over well?
Yeah, it went down an absolute storm. I mean, you know, things are absolutely flying for us in America. It was going, it couldn't have been gone any better, you know. And I, having been someone, I've never ever thought, you've made it or done with having failed so many times. You know what I mean? I've never been someone who actually believed that we'd ever made it. And I remember that just a couple of days before our album was due to release, the second one, 6 Million Ways to Live, it was number 2 in the billboards. We were like, we're on the front cover of every major magazine. We're all over the radio. Everything was going absolutely fine. And for the first time in my life, I remember just thinking to myself, cracked it. We're the number one priority for the biggest fucking record label in the world. And for the first time in my life, I fucking nailed this. And 2 days before I was up the, I was in New York and I was up the Trade Towers and I flew to Los Angeles to start our tour. And that was the week release of the album. And then I just remember being in a friend's house, sitting there watching these aeroplanes, like, you know, and just watching them hit the towers and just knowing at that moment the whole world had changed, and as well as a load, you know, the whole tragic thing of it, that our record would never come out. Do you know what I mean? And that basically was it. That was the end of our career there. Do you know what I mean? Because it was suddenly, you know, Geffen asked, they said, obviously they couldn't release the record. Do you know what I mean? The lyrics were blowing up the White House like it was an alien, and tallest buildings burn, our other mothers, they cry, things I'd written, you know, years, but 2 years before.
So isn't that wild?
Yeah, no, it's just, I mean, yeah, I guess it's sort of, you know.
Was there any way of just like taking out certain songs, or did you not want to do that?
No, it wasn't. There was nothing going to be released in the music industry. I mean, you had to get out of the country. The whole, you know, we're about to go war. It was like, there was no music industry then. It was just, everything was like, you know.
So kind of like a different way of it, but like it is now,
like
the whole
COVID
thing just
now,
shut down.
Absolutely. Well, this is what I'm saying to you, you know, my company's called What the Fuck Could Possibly Go Wrong Limited. This year, you know, we talk about, so that was basically, that was it. And it took 2 years, Geffen offered me like, I think $200,000 to stay and said they would come back with my record another day. But mine, and this was my decision, and I, you know, I can live to regret it for the rest of my life, or, you know, I never know if I got it right or wrong. But I said, in my experience, I didn't think once you've been on the front burner for a record label, and then you're put on the back burner, you'll ever come back. Do you know what I mean? So I asked them numerous times. And
to be released.
Heated debates to let me go, which eventually they agreed to do, but they actually took 2 years to do that. I thought we'd walk out of that, get another deal, no problem, because of the way we did, and everybody was like, well, why would the biggest record company in the world let you go? Do you know what I mean? So it was like...
Could you not make another album as well because you were contracted to them for the one you'd done?
It was exactly that. So, that I mean, that happened. And it's kind of weird, like you say, now that that happened then. And I actually think this year, I thought stupidly again, with the festival and everything going well, and with the touring that we had lined up, and everything we had lined up for the year, that this was going to be an amazing year. And stupidly enough, my album release date is the 9/11, and the date of my festival is 9/11 again, and it's all gone completely tits. It's like, what was you thinking, you stupid?
Well, if it wasn't for COVID, though, things could have been great, you know.
if it wasn't for 9/11, it would have been great.
Worldwide pandemics, you know, and mass terror attacks. So, you say the world changed in that moment. What were the direct effects that you witnessed?
Well, I mean,
as kind of an Englishman in that country at that time.
Nobody was putting out any records. Nobody was doing anything. All the whole world was concentrating on was Iraq and Saddam. Do you know what I mean? It was like we were going to war, and that was all that. That was. I remember this being, you know, America. I mean, just the television, the whole tone of everything was dark. Everything was just horrendous. Do you know? So. The last thing on anybody's mind was music. Do you know what I mean? It was like they wanted blood. And yeah. That was it. You know, somebody had to pay. I remember watching, you know, American television. Afghanistan, it's a car park. Bin Laden, he's a dead man. It's like, and they're like, no. You know, and we're still in that shit now. It's,
absolutely. I interviewed Fass from Fun Loving Criminals this week, and he was saying, as a New York guy, he was like, that was the day the world changed forever.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Like, absolutely.
Freedoms getting taken away and fear getting introduced. And obviously all those things were there to some extent before, but it was just magnified tenfold, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Of course it was. It was used to empower. And obviously it was, you know... Well, you know, I don't want to accuse any nation of who did it, but we know where the funding for it came from. And it's, you know, and we know Saddam didn't have weapons of mass destruction. He might have been a loudmouth git, but he wasn't like, you know.
Yeah, where were they?
America's number one terrorist, you know what I mean? So they changed that, you know, and like you say, the world changed. And the same thing's happening with COVID, you know, that's redrawing the whole of the control patterns.
Absolutely. And like wherever you go now, you've got to sign in, haven't you?
Got to sign in, you've got to trace. Not to say that you haven't, you know, I mean, you know, the conspirators can say that, you know, I'm not going to have this track and trace or not, but you've got a mobile phone, mate. You've got a flipping credit card. You've got like Facebook. Yeah. Stop being a twat.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's just like, you know.
Yeah, they've already got you.
They've already got you, mate. Do you know what I mean? You know.
So what did you do afterwards then? Did you just stay in America and tour?
The years that followed.
About?
They were just dark, to be honest.
Really?
Did
you feel like it was all over?
No, I didn't feel anything because I kept waiting for the record to be released. You know, I kept waiting for Geffen to let me go. So I couldn't write another album. I didn't want to write another album because I had one that already hadn't come out, and I always believed it would come out. But nothing really happened. Richard Bishop, who was our manager, managed to get us a whole load of films and things like that. So financially, I had some money coming in, but.
Is that around the time all the soundtrack stuff started happening with Blade?
And all that. So, I mean, I managed to carry on doing that, came back here and started to put the pieces back together again here. But, you know, there was a lot of drink and drugs going on at the time. And
not in an upbeat, jovial, happy, celebratory kind of a way. Or was it still good times some of the time?
It was pretty self-destructive. It was pretty self-destructive. I mean, we would, you know, we were getting gigs and we were doing great shows, but we would end up having a, you know, there would always be a drama every night. There would always be a punch-up between us. There would be
internally.
Internally. Do you know what I mean? It was like, you know, it was your worst fucking nightmare. Do you know what I mean? It was like, you know, and to be honest, some, you know, a lot of the shows started to become shambolic. Do you know what I mean? It was more about the party than it was about the performance. Do you know what I mean? So
professionalism kind of went out the window for a bit.
Do you know what I mean? Which I think happens to a lot of bands, but it got really bad. It got embarrassingly bad. Do you know what I mean? And then
Thank God all of that's pre-social media, eh? Because bands can't do that now. If they do one show out their mind, it's on YouTube and everyone's like, look at these guys, they're awful, and that's it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's hard to come back from.
Yeah, I'll pass on that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How was America, though? I mean, you must have had some great times out there playing shows and exploring the country. And how was partying out there compared to the UK club scene? Like, what was their nightlife like? Was it ecstasy fuel? Was it a different drug?
No, it wasn't. It was cocaine was more their drug. There wasn't really like a club scene. Like there was, you know, electronic music hadn't really blown up there, even though, you know, it was Chicago house, Detroit techno, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, New York disco and God knows what, you know, and all the house legends. And like I say, well, most of the gods of and pioneers of electronic music came from America. It was never really an American thing. You know what I mean? And so,
and there certainly wasn't like super clubs or anything like that.
No, they all had to come over here to make their names, you know. So it wasn't like that at all. It was more sort of like gigs and bars, do you know what I mean? And
yeah,
and strip joints and, you know, so it was, yeah, it was just all that kind of thing, really.
What was the most lavish expense around that time?
I don't know.
Or is it just constant?
It was just constant. It was constant. We were flying around in jets. I think it was, you know, hanging out at a Versace mansion, just like, you know, just whores and gear.
Any actors on the scene?
I'm not gonna fingerprint, you know, I'm not gonna put anybody in the frame. But yeah, it was great times, do you know what I mean? I mean, the amount of people used to come to our shows just amazed me. Do you know what I mean? Still does now. No, so
when you come back to the UK, because you were mentioning earlier on about how, like, you know, all the fat boy slim kind of people really taking off, did you manage to avoid being, you know, lumped and restricted in with that scene because you had been stateside for a bit? And did that allow you to evolve and grow as a band in the years that followed musically?
Yeah, the backlash was over by the time we came back. Do you know what I mean? So, and we'd totally changed in sound and it look, and everything of the band had changed. Do you know what I mean? It was like a song based orientated band then. So it was suddenly, I'm not saying like, we were free of the, I mean, I used to, everywhere I used to go, people like would still be into their breakbeat. Do you know what I mean? It was like, why are you only playing the bigger of the breaks? I'm not doing that anymore. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you know, and people always remember you for that kind of one sound or one record, but it was like we'd moved on. And luckily enough now, obviously, 8 albums later, people kind of understand that we go, or I go, wherever we want to go. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that's the way it is. And people now can see that over a period of time. Do you know what I mean? But I think if you've just made one record, then people just want one sound.
Of course. Or even when you've got one hit and one song that's like the song that defines you.
I guess, again, luckily not having hits is...
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Just loads of like consistently good. I kind of know this one. Yeah, it's good. Yeah. How did Terry Hall come into the picture? And did he offer you friendship and advice through that kind of stalling,
not
crumbling.
Really. I was surprised that he stayed, did as many shows as he did with us, because but he'd seen it all before with the specials. Do you know what I mean? So Terry's got a really dry sense of humour. He's a really
you can
great,
see that even on stage.
He's a fantastic character,
dry and sardonic, and these
and he'd seen it all before. Do you know what I mean? Our childish behaviour was nothing new to him. Do you know what I mean? It was like, you know, Johnny being dragged out of hotels handcuffed was like, you know, just roll of the eyes, really. No, he never really offered us any advice. He, like I said, it was just an honour to work with him, and it obviously sort of gave us a massive kudos. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But the problem is, Terry would only do like two songs with us, and they'd be generally towards the end of the set. So halfway, you know, for most of the show, people were shouting, "Where the fucking hell's Terry? Where's Terry?" Do you know what I mean? It was just Terry Hall fans had turned up to see the band.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But, you know.
But hopefully you're winning them over in the process. After three songs, they're tired of screaming. So they go, fine, we'll get into it.
Get into
We've it. Paid.
Yeah.
And then the third record, he's on quite a few tracks, isn't he? Like the Peaches cover, Rapture.
Speakers and Tweeters. Yeah. That's when he really sort of came in. Obviously, we did Problem Is on 6 Million Ways to Live, but then we did Rapture. But again, that was kind of like more, I think that come from some sort of branded gig that we got that wanted us to do, I think it was Rizzler or something, wanted us to do some shows together, and they wanted artists to do covers of other artists. So that's why we did those songs. Do you know what I mean? That's why we did Rapture and things like that.
Peaches.
Peaches. So that it was part of a project. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't kind of a... And we just thought Rapture would work really well for Terry, just because of his sort of melancholy voice. Do you know what I mean? It was just
I guess that was one of those
twists on it.
Punk new wave songs to incorporate rap and hip hop.
Yeah, absolutely.
Into it, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was. Yeah, no, it was. You know, awesome. I mean, I've got nothing but love for Terry, nothing but love for Linville, and Horace. You know, I think they're fantastic guys.
You've worked with loads of amazing people. Like Rodney P's been on so many tracks as well.
Yeah, again, Rodney, I first met Rodney in a snowboarding event in somewhere in the Alps, World Championships or something, Orange Snowboarding Championships. And him and Skits were there. And the first thing they did was throw some pills down our throat. And I thought,
brilliant.
You guys are dub pistols, do you know what I mean? It was like, and I never thought of the UK hip hop scene like that. Do you know what I mean? I always thought it was
more
spliff tough. Do you know what I mean? Not, you know,
bravado,
not partying, like, you know, all loved up.
Do you know what
I mean? So Rodney just fitted straight into the bill. Do you know what I mean? And it was like, you know, he was a perfect pistolero. And he's got so much charisma, do you know what I mean? And obviously being the pioneer of UK hip hop and using, like, you know, your native tongue, your native sort of tone, rather than trying to be American, was like, you know, it was totally new. He's one of my best friends now today. Do you know, I'm still to this, you know, we speak every week. You know, he came and sung Mucky Weekend at my wedding.
Amazing.
You know, it's just like, yeah.
He just stylistically seemed to fit in so well with the sound.
Yeah,
as well.
It was perfect. It was a perfect timing for us to get him on board. And you know, at that time, as you can see, like, you know, the lineup, having Terry Hall and...
I was checking that out.
And Rodney P, all in one band, was pretty unique.
It's a proper gang,
It was a crew, do you know what I mean? So, you know, you had London Posse, you had the Specials, and you had the Dub Pistols all in one sort of super group-ish. Not so super, but a group.
Have you worked with anyone that was like problematic to work with or difficult?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think Gregory Isaacs was an absolute nightmare.
How so? If we can go there.
I mean, I've worked with a few problematic people, but Gregory was, he was quite clearly and well known that he was on the crack. Do you know what I mean? So we had to wait while we were recording. My publicist and everyone had told me to stay away from him and not bother him because
of the trouble that comes with him.
It was going to be a nightmare. And but you know, I'd absolutely love Gregory Isaacs, was a massive fan, and thought we'll take a punt. So we had to go. We agreed to, he was playing at the Jazz Cafe, and we agreed to meet him the next day in a recording studio in South London, and it turned out to be in the middle of a council estate in this crack den, and we had to wait there all day. Must have waited about, like, I don't know, 10 hours.
10 hours?
For him to turn up. He finally turned up. He was all clearly out of his mind. And just as we had to hand over a carry bag full of cash, which we gave him, and he basically went in, played him the track. He sung the song and said, "That's it." And we said, "No, it's like, let's start working on the idea." He went, "No, it's one take, that's it. That's all we're doing." No, let's start working on the song now. We're here to make a record. And he basically got a bit, his crew got a bit heavy, and we asked for our money back. So we just give you the thing, and he just obviously clearly didn't give us our money back. Do you know what I mean? And we, luckily, the engineer gave us the tape, and we basically had to run for our lives.
And you got it. You got the take. It wasn't ideal.
No, it was an absolute pile of shit.
Was it?
Yeah. He sort of mumbled his way through this thing. We managed to cobble it together and get a chorus out of it, but it was no.
It's like with the Sean Ryder Gorillaz track.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's there.
Like, yeah, it's pretty that much bit. That. It's it. You know what I mean? It's like, and it's, yeah.
And what about Buster? What was Buster like?
Well, Buster we never worked with. We worked with, but we never worked with in the studio, but it was a satellite thing.
Got you.
So we made a beat. He sung the vocal. He sent it to us.
He's an insane talent, though, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely insane. And then 2 weeks, and he loved the track, and then about a day before we had to finish the track, or the day we finished the track, and it had been in the film forever, the day before the final sign-off, he decided he didn't like the beat and wanted the whole thing changed. So we had to redo the whole thing, do you know what I mean? Remake the whole song, literally, like, in a few hours. So it was like, all right, nice one, Buster. Cheers. But we got paid well for it, so...
There you go.
And we worked with Busta Rhymes, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a good one to tick off the list, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty big.
Is there anywhere left in the world that you haven't yet taken the band that you would still like to?
I've never been to Japan. I'd love to go to Japan. I've never been to Japan, believe it or not.
You haven't DJed down there or anything? Or?
No, I've done the whole of Asia, pretty much everywhere in the world. And I've never done South Africa. So maybe they're the two places that I haven't played, which God knows why.
Well, I guess for a while, a lot of artists were reluctant to go there because of apartheid, weren't they?
Absolutely, yeah.
All of that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's obviously still got problems now, but I'd still like to go and visit it, for the last 15 years, we could have gone there, and we've just never been invited. Do you know what I mean? So,
where's some of the sketchiest places you've had to play? Because sometimes you see, like, and you hear stories more about the promoters than the crowds.
There's been a few. I've been thrown out of a few countries as well. But Hong Kong, the promoter, basically just fucking abandoned me. He just put so much coke up his nose and booked me into a room, which was somebody else's room. It wasn't my hotel. You know, he said to send that limo for me. The whole thing just turns into a sham, and I had to do a runner out the hotel. And luckily I had a Chinese friend who was just over the border that came over and flipping sort of rescued me. So that was pretty shady. And then he turned around and told my agent that I'd run up a £25,000 bar bill in the room. Do you know what I mean? Which is pretty fucking difficult. Do you know what I mean? It's
like, yeah, just on booze. Yeah.
It's like, it's total bullshit. Do you know what I mean? But he was like, basically, he's
total cowboy.
He was an absolute charlatan. Yeah. It was horrendous. That was a dark experience. Yeah, there was a time in Croatia where I got completely live on national television and to a big show, and I got completely hammered, and I accidentally insulted the whole nation, to where we got bottled off stage and taken to the airport and thrown out of the country.
That's a tough crowd, right?
That's, mate, it's terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Johnny Agutaris, Croatian. I just one of those drunken, stupid things that you say, and you just, I regretted it for a long time afterwards, because it was just so stupid and just, you know, it was just like, you know, like I said, but it was a drunken remark that you thought would go down funny, and you totally misjudged it.
Misread the room.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there was fighting on stage with bottles raining down. You know what I mean? Literally, the military police fucking marched us. I was headbutting the window of the tour bus saying, is this how you treat your guests? Is it? But we were lucky enough to go back. I think it was last year or the year before. I think last year. And I was so glad that we actually did, because it was about 10 years that we were banned from that country. And I was so ashamed of ourselves. Do you know what I mean? It was like we actually managed to go back and redeem ourselves. Do you know what I mean? And apologise. So, I was glad that one was over. Off.
A happy ending.
Yeah.
In terms of like absolute euphoria or just out of control excitement or scale, or just some of like those all-time best shows you've ever played, which ones stand out?
It's really hard because, again,
there's obviously been so many.
It's not so much that. Yes, I mean, yeah. You'd hope so after 20 plus years. It's the bad ones you remember.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, I get that.
It's not so much the good ones you remember. I think I think it was Rise Festival to something like 50 or 100,000 people in Victoria Park when we first sung Gangsters with Terry, and that was the first time we performed that song with him on stage, and the place went absolutely crazy. I think that was pretty special. That was one of those... Do you know what I mean? I'm on stage with my God, and we're doing Gangsters. That was pretty. There has been so many. I mean, we do the amazing place called Electric Castle in Romania every year. That's absolutely colossal. I've never seen a stage the size of it. I think it's bigger than the pyramid. I think it's the biggest stage I've ever seen, but that's something really special. There has been so many incredible nights. It's, you know, there's also been some absolute howlers.
There's a lot of it in the film.
Yeah.
Have you been filming a lot over the years? Like, has there been a lot of stuff that has been documented retrospectively?
I did used to carry a DV camera around me a hell of a lot and film a lot of places. I thought I'd lost a lot of the tapes, and they have...
they've been unearthed, have they?
They've been unearthed. So there is a lot of that stuff there. And it's amazing how much stuff as well has just turned up on YouTube that other people have filmed and things like that, you know. And there's so much stuff that you actually forgot. You know,
I'll bet. Did you watch the Lavelle documentary? Did you see that one?
No,
that's amazing. That's got, like, you know, whether it's him or his mate, I can't remember, but it's kind of everything,
right?
And it follows his whole journey. Yeah. And, you know, obviously coming from that similar background to you in many ways with the Fabric Club DJ scene, and it takes, to kind of divert slightly, it takes real strength of mind, I think, to go through the trenches in the way that, you know, people like him and you have, come out on the other side with your brain intact, right?
Yeah, but I think it's not. There's no choice. It's like being a boxer, and, like, you know, if you, it doesn't matter how many times you get beaten. Do you know what I mean? If you the minute you stay down, you're down.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just keep picking yourself back up and going for it, you're still in with a chance. Do you know what I mean? You're still in the game, and it's the only thing I know. So it's like, you know, I'm unemployable. Do you know what I mean? It's like, this is what I do. And that's why I'm finding this period so hard, because that's what I do. Is I'm a performer. Do you know what I mean? I perform, and it's like I said, I don't think I have any other acceptable skills. I think my first job I ever had, I was told that I would never get on in a working environment where I came in direct contact with the public.
Brilliant. Proved you wrong. It's all public.
Yeah, there you go.
How about the come downs, Barry? Did they get worse as the years went on, or have you managed to walk that tightrope line and
the cocaine I knocked on the head, it was getting out of control anyway. I wasn't enjoying myself. I mean, apart from being bloody expensive, it was down to my wife, really. There was a night, we was at the Concord 2, and I had a meltdown, and I was at the top of the stairs there where they were trying to drag me out, and I was like, these are my people, and it was just a total cocaine psychosis meltdown, and the wife just said, that's it. She wasn't my wife at the time, she just said, it's up to you, Coke on me, and like, and anyway, I kind of, what, like I said, wasn't enjoying it anymore. Do you know what I mean? It was like, it was becoming too, it was too many times when I was having a bad time. And if you were on stage or if you were DJing and something went wrong, then it went horribly wrong. Do you know what I mean? It completely went tits up, and you know, and then I'd suddenly, you know, that psychotic coked up maniac. Do you know what I mean? And I wasn't, you know, so I don't miss that at all. Do you know what I mean? I was, you know, pills being loved up, no problem. Problem is now, like you say, the come down, we got so busy that I can't be partying 24/7 where, because we've got to be at the airport or we've got to be somewhere else or we've got to be here. Whereas before it was like,
you're on the move, I was just constantly, yeah.
Yeah. So it was like, you know, I haven't got time, don't have time for a come down. And now, like you say, yeah, the come downs, if you do get off your nut, just take forever and get harder. Do you know what I mean? So you just kind of naturally grow out of it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I think some people do it earlier, some people do it later.
Yeah, I was later.
You've obviously had your,
I was later,
your fair share, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't regret none of it. I think I would be a lot wealthier had I not. Music magazine, when it was about, they used to give an award out called Caner of the Year. Brandon Block had won it, Dave Beer won it. The very last year it was, they gave it to me, and I just said I wouldn't accept it, and not because I just didn't want to be responsible to be an influence in anybody else taking drugs, having lost so many friends.
You know, have you through, lost a lot of,
yeah,
you?
Yeah, you know, through ODs and, you know what I mean, and what have you, yeah. So I just didn't want to be responsible for, you know, and an addiction, obviously.
Yeah.
I just didn't want somebody else to take a drug because I might have influenced them to do that. Do you know what I mean? Even though clearly I probably have, and some of our songs would suggest that.
Well, it's a choice, isn't it? And I think what you're saying there is it doesn't necessarily work for everybody. It's worked for me. I've chosen to do it. I've had good experiences from it, but I've also had bad. And I would never say to anybody else, you should definitely do it. It's like, probably don't, but...
No, and you know, I mean, like I said, yeah. I mean, I've lost a few friends through ODs, you know, seen a hell of a lot of horrible things through addiction. And so I just, you know, like I said, I wouldn't want to be responsible for someone going down that path. I've had some fantastic times, and then I've had some really dark times through it, so...
Will some of those stories be in the?
Yeah, I mean, it's all there. I mean, it's a very much you know, it's just an honest take on what happened. Do you know what I mean? And what is happening? Because, you know, just as you think we're about to sail off into the sunset, suddenly 2020's made it a whole different ending again.
Well, was the film going to be coming out this year?
Yeah,
was it?
And yeah, everything was going to come out again. Everything,
and it's all rests
well
on the ending,
well,
doesn't it?
Saying,
a story like that.
It's like, just as you think there's going to be a happy ending, there isn't.
Yeah. So it will continue being sort of,
yeah,
I guess, updated into,
yeah, we
2021,
well
will it?
It's got to be.
Yeah.
It's,
well, you need a happy ending, don't you?
Well, it's not going to have one.
That's so, life.
As you're kicking the balls for you, you know?
Mate, I've really enjoyed chatting to you today.
Yeah, no, it's been,
it's
a pleasure,
been great.
Mate.
And when things are, you know, up and running again, I'd love to come down and see you do your thing.
Yeah, no, but honestly,
either at a festival or a club show, or
you're welcome to any show, you're welcome to any of our rider that you would like.
And, lovely.
Yeah, and it'd be great to see you somewhere, mate, in a field or in a club or a venue, whatever.
But nice.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure, man. Thanks a lot.
Peace, I'm out. You know how it goes. I'm standing at the door of the club, breath smelling like a pub, getting VIP love, cause the people know my name. There's cocaine running around in my brain, so I chat to everybody, the cocaine's to blame. The chick that I'm with is a dime, she looks flamed, but I really don't remember her name, so hey-ho. The party's in the VIP, you wanna go? I got a little hydro weed, you wanna roll? She was like, no, I don't smoke, Joe. But you got any blow, and I was like, yeah, there you go. Click, next thing she's dancing on the bar top. Click, next thing I'm unbuckling the bra top. Oh no, here we go again. I'm on my face, another hockey weekend. One day I'm gonna have some kids and a wife, but until then, I'm just gonna live my life.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.